Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Today I had originally planned a debate between a fellow named John Moffat and Judy Wood, but John Moffat, who is apparently a physician, who had posted an article on Op-Ed News that was critical of the very idea of directed energy weapons having been involved. When I suggested that he might want to review Judy's work at drjudywood.com, he wrote back and explained that he had a negative impression. Dr. Wood cannot, here's a quote from an email he sent me. Dr. Wood could not possibly have determined that DE weapons were used based solely on looking at photos. And you know that to be true. Is science done by looking at pictures that someone else took? Please point to a single scientific article in a peer-reviewed journal that was done by looking at six-year-old photos of an event. Any discussion between Dr. Wood and myself would be just two people talking past each other. I'd ask what kind of energy was used, and she would say she can't speculate, despite the fact that all of her analysis of photos is pure speculation. She is very selective in what she will speculate about. This, to me, was very disappointing. I mean, photography and observation is obviously fundamental to science. If you're talking about an event that's 6 years old, you're going to have to be dependent on photos that were taken 6 years ago. I mean, anyone who's even familiar with, television programs about forensic investigations like Cold Case File or Law and Order and so forth, when they're dealing with cases, they trade frequently in photographs. That's some of the most basic evidence. And in this case, of course, the fact that drjudywood.com provides what I take to be the most extensive, thorough, and comprehensive documentation of the degree and extent of the devastation at the World Trade Center makes this response from John Moffat virtually incomprehensible. And when he goes on to suggest that he would ask questions that he is, in my opinion, implying would be too specific or more specific than Dr. Wood would be able to answer, I think he's just taking for granted the specificity with which answers ought to be presently available, or the extent to which she would be able to respond in an appropriate fashion given the state of research. So John Moffat will not be here today, we have been able to secure the presence of an equal eminent, because I not only have Dr. Judy Wood on the phone, but I have Jerry Liepart here too, who of course is the distinguished attorney from Connecticut who has been admitted to the bar in New York and New Jersey as well as his home state, and who has been the pioneer of a number of legal actions, submissions under the Data Quality Act and other statutes that are, in my opinion, promising to shatter the official governmental cover-up. It's extremely promising, and most recently, in the subject of our discussion today, will be a brand new lawsuit that Judy Wood has filed against companies that were working for the NIST, a QI-TAM lawsuit, and it'll be a fascinating discussion today. It's a great pleasure to welcome on the Dynamic Duo Judy Wood and Jerry Liepart. Welcome. Judy?
Yes.
Yeah.
Both here.
Good. Welcome. Jerry, you there?
Yes. Good afternoon.
Tremendous. I want to say, we have just released a new press announcement of this finding of the lawsuit, and I think it's extremely important that it's out there. Judy, would you like to give us a little background of what inspired you to do this, how conversation with Jerry may have led to this result?
Well, this was submitted back in April, and it's under seal, so we couldn't talk about it until recently, and it's still great to be able to talk about it.
Well, let me say a few words, Jim, about the process, and that is that this is a, as you know, a QI-TAM lawsuit, meaning that Dr. Wood is actually suing on behalf of the United States of America. Now, Judy just indicated that the lawsuit was actually filed back in April under seal, meaning that nothing could be said about it, including the fact that, or including the identity of the defendants. Now, what this lawsuit does is that it asserts that fraud was committed by the contractors who were retained by NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, to provide NIST supposedly with professional expertise and consulting services, enabling them to prepare their report on what caused the destruction of the Twin Towers and of the World Trade Center complex. And instead of doing that, our assertion, as contained in Dr. Wood's lawsuit, is that these companies who were retained by NIST instead steered NIST directly in the opposite direction, that is to say, from not only not finding out what caused the destruction of the World Trade Center, but steering them in a completely opposite direction, such that at the end of the day, the NIST report did not even describe the actual event of destruction, but instead stopped short of that and completed and completely ignored the actual destructive phase, saying that all they needed to do was describe events in a very general way up to the point where the actual destruction started. They used the phrase initiation of collapse. Now, to any ordinary person for whom the expectation will have been set that they will learn why and how the World Trade Center was destroyed, to then be told after 10,000 pages of research and $20 million spent that, okay, we're only going to describe what happened up to the point where the actual destruction began, that sounds fraudulent. And that is what the lawsuit maintains, and it is brought against the companies that NIST relied on for technical expertise. Now, at a certain point, Jim, I can tell you that I, as an individual, speaking not as a lawyer or anything else, but just as an ordinary person, I had a jaw-dropping experience in this process when I learned that two of the major contractors that NIST relied on to provide it with technical expertise and services are companies who are themselves among those who are most directly involved in the development, manufacture, and testing utilization of directed energy weapons.
Jerry, that's a fascinating point. Hold that thought. We'll return to it. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guests, Judy Wood and Jerry Liepart. Stand by. Today, my special guests are attorney Jerry Liepart and Dr. Judy Wood, and we're talking about a newly filed lawsuit, a quietom lawsuit by Judy Wood. And just to, we have made a press release about this that is available to the public now at Op-Ed News, and it'll soon be posted on the Scholar's website and distributed to the members of the Society. Let me read the abstract for background as we continue. A prominent member of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, Dr. Judy Wood, has filed a quietom lawsuit against several companies that were contracted by the National Institute for Standards and Technology, NIST, to provide technical assistance to NIST, alleging fraud in the work they performed concerning the official investigation of why and how the World Trade Center complex was destroyed on 9/11. Dr. Wood, formerly a professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University, has amassed evidence about the destruction of the World Trade Center in support of her suit, which has now been unsealed by the court and made available to the public. Judy, Jerry, I just got to say, this looks to me like a very significant development. I'm just
very proud to have you as members of Scholars.
We'll try to do what we can, Jim. Now, the first thing I need to do is to teach you and how to pronounce the name of these lawsuits, and it is Keatam.
Keatam. Good.
And,
well, I'm always willing to learn.
Okay, and let me...
Languages were never my specialty, apart from English.
Okay, and what it essentially means is, you know, Keatam is a shortening of... an old English / Latin phrase that literally means on behalf of our Lord the King, and it basically the premise of a Keatam lawsuit is that a citizen acts for purposes of protecting the sovereign when that citizen becomes aware of fraud having taken place and then acts to bring that fraud to the attention of the sovereign. If the sovereign does not act, then the citizen does so. So before the break, I indicated that the lawsuit had been filed back in April. Under seal.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that the state in the personage of the Attorney General, yes, Gonzo, as he then was, and the U.S. Attorney for the area where the action was filed, in this instance in New York City, in the federal district court called the Southern District of New York, then has a period of 60 days in which to decide whether to do one of three things. The U.S. Attorney in New York can decide to handle the case on their own, can decide to try to have the case dismissed, or can decline to intervene and then allow the citizen who brought the case, who is given the title the relator, the opportunity to go to court and pursue the matter in their own behalf or in behalf of the United States, acting as a citizen relator. And that is what happened here. The U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York declined to intervene and thus paved the way for Dr. Wood to pursue this action on behalf of the United States of America. Now, I'm going to say one other thing, Jim, and then I'm going to kind of turn this over to Dr. Wood. Your listeners should know that a key element in these lawsuits depends upon the person who brought them to qualify as a, quote, original source, unquote, of the information or the fraud upon which the case is based. Now, in our community, that is to say among those who are active in the 9/11 truth movement, it's fair to say that Dr. Wood is synonymous with the claim that directed energy weapons were a causal factor in the destruction of the World Trade Center. She then parlayed that information into a claim that was filed against NIST requesting correction of the report that they issued. She is, in fact, the original source of that work and on a literal and figurative basis. And it is on that basis that we will seek to satisfy the original source requirement. Now, the final thing that your listeners need to know is that as Keatam law has developed, one of the most difficult things that one can try to do is to qualify as an original source. It just simply is one of those areas of law, Jim, where the rule is fraught with an almost unlimited number of exceptions, such that it is very difficult to qualify as an original source. So chances are the next time we have something newsworthy to say about this case, it will have to do with how the issue of qualifying as an original source is progressing. Okay?
Yes, yes. Could you review again exactly the conditions necessary to qualify properly as an original source?
Well, I will attempt to do so in a brief fashion. But again, as I indicated before, it's an area that is fraught with a number of exceptions such that it is not easy, even among lawyers, to describe the requirements for original source. But I will try to do so. First of all, you have to distinguish between information that is publicly disclosed versus information that is developed by the relator. And often a case like this will flounder on the basis of a claim that the information was publicly disclosed and therefore cannot give rise to the original source requirement.
Stand by, stand by. We'll be right back with my special guests, Jerry Liepart and Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guests are Judy Wood and Jerry Liepart, and we're talking about a QI-TAM lawsuit that Judy has filed on behalf of the United States of America against an assortment of companies that were involved in the NIST's research on what happened to the World Trade Center, especially the Twin Towers, where under this suit, Dr. Woods is alleging fraud by these different companies that they diverted the NIST from information it should have had that it was entitled to possess in conducting its research. And all of this falls, I take it, rather broadly under the Data Quality Act, but I'm going to turn this to Jerry Liepart to elaborate further and especially give us this capsule summary of what it takes to be an original source.
Okay, Jim, that's a nice lead-in. And since you did that and since I know you have a very knowledgeable and inquiring listening audience, I think I'd be remiss in not giving the a more fulsome statement about where the words QI-TAM come from.
Sure.
And the actual phrase is QI-TAM pro domino rege. And that, literally means, on behalf of the Lord Sovereign or the King. And we shorten that to QI-TAM in using it as an expression of what kind of case has been filed.
Or you expand the Latin phrase to include pro se ipso in hoc parte sequitur, meaning he who sues the king as well as for himself.
Okay,
you
pulled up the whole thing. That's I'm talking. That's what professors are supposed to do. Okay, well done, Jim. You're a fast learner.
Carry on, counselor.
Okay, so on original source, I had before the break started by saying that the relator has to have direct and independent knowledge of the information on which the claim is based and has voluntarily provided the information before filing the QI-TAM action. Now, there's a third requirement there, and that is the source or the place where the information has been voluntarily provided also comes along with some qualifiers, and the person cannot have provided or voluntarily provided that information in a context where they could receive monetary compensation for having done so.
If I might interject a comment here, Jerry, then it seems to me that the fact that Judy has made these previous filings, requests for correction to NIST, was a necessary condition to be in the position to bring a QI-TAM lawsuit against the agency and these companies. And, of course, none of it was done for monetary gain. And most importantly, perhaps, she has made unique and distinctive contributions here with, a massive number of observations about these events that are distinctive to her as the origination.
Well, Jim, I could not have said it more clearly myself. You hit the nail on the head with the hammer. And not only that, but her response from NIST concerning the allegations that directed energy weapons were used and that ARA, among others, were manufacturers of such weapons, NIST responded by saying, "We didn't know that."
Well, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful that, here she's providing extremely relevant information that they're claiming was unavailable to them previously. This seems to me to place her in an awfully strong position for qualification under these conditions you're describing.
Hello.
Jerry, you and Judy are the dynamic duo. It's not me and Kevin, I got to say.
Well, Jim, as I said,
we're in your shadow. We're in your shadow, my friend.
Oh, no, Jim, it's an effort, and you already know, you are going to be called on to assist here. This is literally a situation, Jim, where, I'm not fond of military expressions necessarily, but this is a time for all hands on deck.
Yes. Man your battle stations.
Yeah, so there will be a lot of work to do to assemble the supporting information that will be needed in order to satisfy the technical prerequisites for that original source issue that we've touched upon.
Mm-hmm.
So, I really think at this point there's probably little else that I can or should say about these matters. And
yeah,
I will also say that for your listeners or for those who might think that information is being withheld or that we've not told them enough about the case, that's not true. When you discuss ongoing legal procedures, whether you're a lawyer or the person bringing the case, you have to abide by certain rules. We can't try these cases in the public. We have to do so in court. So there are limitations on what we can say about ongoing litigation matters, or else we run the risk of getting our knuckles wrapped a little bit by the court. You can get a gag order imposed on you, or you can get a stern look from a judge who says the word counselor and then this, that, keep your mouth shut. And so we don't want to get to that point. And so your listeners should know that whenever we can say something, about the case as it develops, we will do so, and we will also say whatever we can about it while, abiding by those rules. And as you know, lawyers always tell their clients, not to say too much because whatever, for example, whatever, Judy might say about this case, we have to assume that those who are going to try to prevent her from succeeding will try to find ways to use what she says about the case against her. So just be mindful of that while it might on occasion seem as though we are being, a little, standoffish, or we're not being forthcoming, it's simply because we have to abide by the rules on what can be said about pending lawsuits.
Yes. Now, given that it has been unsealed, Jerry, I take it that for Judy to have it posted on her website or for me to distribute the link so people could read it for themselves is perfectly appropriate.
That is correct, because what unsealing means literally is that the papers that have been filed in the case, including the complaint, are a matter of public record for those who have access to court records. And so that means that, just as you say, what Judy has posted on her website, which does in fact include the complaint in the case, that can be seen by the public simply because it is a matter of public record.
Well, I'll just say, just opening this up and starting to scan it, I can understand how why Judy was unavailable for conversations with me when she was working on this. I'll provide the link as soon as we return. We're with my special guest, Judy Wood and Jerry Liepart. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guests today are the activist attorney, Jerry Liepart, and the 9/11 researcher, Judy Wood, who has expertise in many areas related to 9/11 research, but especially at the World Trade Center. She has her Key Tam lawsuit has now been unsealed by a federal judge, George Daniels, of the Southern District of New York. Although it was filed on April 25th, it has been kept under seal until the 12th of September. And it may be found on her website at drjudywood.com/articles/NIST in caps/Key_Tam_Wood, and that's Key is capital Q-U-I underscore T-A-M underscore Wood with the Q and the T and the W capitalized, period, H-T-M-L. And as I look at this thing, it's very...
Jim,
yeah.
There's now a link to the page from my front page. And it's listed with today's show.
Oh, there is a link there now?
Yeah.
Oh, so you can just go to drjudywood.com and get a link.
Right. It's the top of the news section, the big yellow box, and it lists today's show, and it's right at the top of the box.
Oh, fantastic, Judy. You're so good at this. And now, as you may have heard me remark in passing, now I understand why you're so seldom available for conversations when I would call. You've been preoccupied with some awfully important stuff, and it's very impressive. I got to say, even in relation to our discussions and preparation of the press release, the definition that the government, that NIST is appealing to for the word collapse, is very odd, very strange, and strained in terms of language. According to the NIST definition, a collapse is a falling in, loss of shape, or reduction to flattened form or rubble of a structure. I'll repeat that. A falling in, loss of shape, or reduction to flattened form or rubble of a structure. Where, as I remark in the release, that definition would even be consistent with the destruction of the building by means of a nuclear explosion, which flattened it and turned it to rubble.
But it wouldn't be falling in.
Well, no, it's an or, Judy. That's a disjunction. What that means is it doesn't require all of those things. It requires any of those things. It says a falling in, loss of shape, or reduction to flattened form or rubble of a structure, which makes it very general. I mean, the thing that required a falling in would be more consistent with ordinary language. I'm looking at Webster right here, and it says collapse, to fall in or together as when supports or sides fail to hold, cave in, shrink together suddenly, to break down suddenly, fail, vanish as the enemy's defense collapse, to break down or fall suddenly in health, to fold or come together compactly, to collapse. Well, of course, we're going to define it that way. A sudden breakdown, a failure, a breakdown, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I just think this is kind of a contorted definition. It didn't strike you that way yourself?
Yeah, they never had defined it that way before. They changed the definition.
Yeah.
And I would say not only that, Jim, but that definition describes events that took place beyond the time frame that their actual report deals with. Now, I know that's a little bit strained, but when they say that their analysis stopped at the point where initiation of collapse began,
right,
then they give Dr. Wood a definition that refers to events that went beyond the analytical point that defined. You know what? That comes very close to being arbitrary.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, without getting into any sticky issues, this is a very nice, straightforward point, I think, in so far as the NIST only carried its analysis to what they called the point of collapse initiation, as though they could presume they had, they didn't actually do that, we know, of course, because they appealed to the fires, the jet plane impact, the weakening of the steel, none of which was actually physically possible under the circumstances that were obtaining at the time, given the highest temperature of a jet-based fuel fire and the melting point of steel and the underwriter's laboratory certification and all that. So this is all impeccable, I think, that they never did what they were tasked to do. I mean, their assignment was to explain how and why the buildings collapsed, and they only executed part of that, and indeed one could argue they did not execute the most important part, namely to actually analyze the collapse. Certainly what they have said about bringing it to the point of collapse initiation is demonstrably refutable, because their whole analysis of collapse initiation is scientifically falsifiable.
That's correct, Jim. Let me, I need to give you a little bit of a weather report. Here in our area, we're undergoing some thunderstorms, so if we lose the connection here, it's not that we hung up, because, you know, it's
okay.
Only, you know, we've got weather going on.
Fair enough, fair enough. Judy, how did you and Jerry get your heads together to recognize that this approach was so promising?
Leave that to Jerry on the approach. That was the brains behind it.
No, that's not the answer.
Well, Jerry, you seem to me to have you know, a genius for understanding how to bring these issues together and how to get a legal grip upon them, which is extraordinarily difficult. I mean, it required great ingenuity to realize that there were the mechanisms available to reach these issues, and to me, that's enormously impressive. I mean, a nice illustration of putting your legal knowledge for the benefit of the public good, and I'm in awe of what you are accomplishing here. I mean, potentially, this could make an enormous difference.
What I think is the one of the most exciting aspects of this is we've heard so many people in the truth movement calling for a new investigation, calling for accountability. We get that opportunity now.
Yeah, we do, and we get it in a civil context, and we get it in a context that's actually going to expose the real issues. So I'm really pleased with this. I mean, as opposed to, just to give you a contrast, I mean, what you're doing here is so responsible, and it is so appropriate. And I contrast it with, say, some of these people's grand juries that have occurred here and there. One out in San Diego turned out to be a fiasco because the participants, the jury members, never even had the opportunity to deliberate, and yet the convener issued a statement about having brought indictments, and it was in my opinion a charade. It was a sham. This is no charade. This is no sham. This is the real deal, and it seems to me to have an enormous potential. I mean, it's something that is actually not just something that could be done. It's something that you actually are doing, and that to me is just enormously important. And I'm just full of admiration for having got this far.
Thanks. And there's a lot of different aspects of this, as you know, that we've been looking through part by part. And what was in the last appeal that I submitted to NIST was about, some of the information that I had gotten off of the web from the ARA website, and they were one of NIST contractors that helped do the analysis.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guests, Dr. Judy Wood and Attorney Jerry Liepart. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Although today was originally going to be a debate between a fellow named John Moffitt, who has authored a piece that appeared in Op-Ed News suggesting that directed energy research was nebulous and unlikely to come to any conclusions or to be even empirically supportable. He declined to come on the show after I invited him to visit Dr. Judy Wood's website, which in my opinion has amassed the most substantial collection of photographs related to the actual destruction of the World Trade Center and its after effects, including the ways in which the cleanup was conducted, apparently feeling that there wasn't a lot for them to say to one another. I'm delighted, however, to report that today is the day of the unsealing of a lawsuit. Actually, that September 12th is the day of the unsealing of a lawsuit filed by Dr. Wood against a variety of companies that were working for NIST for on the basis of fraud, that they should have known better and given more competent advice to NIST, and that as a result of their dereliction, that they violated the Data Quality Act, and NIST provided a false report, perpetrating a form of fraud on the American people, for which she is seeking damages. I think this is going to turn out to be an historic submission, and that and Judy Wood and Jerry Leapart are going to go down here as the true dynamic duo, as opposed to those of us who are talking about and reporting these things. Judy, I can't begin to tell you how much I like what you are doing here and how much how impressed I am with you and Jerry as a team. And I just want to mention, everyone who would like to see, actually look at the suit itself, which has now been unsealed, go to Dr. Wood's website, drjudywood.com, and right at the top you'll see a yellow box that says News. Just click on it. It'll bring you right to it. Judy, tell me, what are your thoughts at this point in time?
Well, one thing, notice today is the 11th of October.
Yes.
And being a true activist, we are to do something on the 11th of every month.
That's right. Kevin here in Madison actually has a meeting of 9/11 activists down at the student union, and very often they're able to sit out on the terrace and, you know, drink beer. Not Kevin, of course, because he's a devout Muslim, but talk about these things and often undertake events. I was even talked into carrying a rather one side of a very large sign that said 9/11 was an inside job as we marched up and down State Street, much to the astonishment of onlookers. And it was captured and filmed by Matt Nowes, who is a founder of Veterans for 9/11 Truth, and I think you can probably find it on YouTube today. So yeah, so that's good, Judy. That's very nice that on the 11th.
If you look at the also the appeal, the complaint doesn't have many pictures in it.
Yeah.
But the appeal that I had just submitted to NIST has a lot of interesting pictures in it, because they didn't, though they need more evidence about ARA's involvement. And in looking through ARA's webpage, I found some interesting photographs that I had been looking for an explanation for some anomalies I had seen at Ground Zero, and here, you know, very plausible descriptions. Do you remember Building 6 with all of
the huge cutouts? Gouge. Yeah.
There's an image that's on ARA's webpage showing a model of what would happen with a particular kind of air blast.
Just for the sake of our listeners, you mean ARA. When you're saying ARAs, you're talking about an company.
Applied Research Associates.
Yes, Applied Research Associates, or ARA, ARA. Go ahead.
And they were one of the contractors on the NIST report. And what's interesting is to look at the pictures side by side. There's a picture taken from inside of Building 6 and one from the Oklahoma City. Then there's the top of Building 6, and then there's their computer model. And it looks very familiar.
Uh-huh.
Which, I've never seen a building with these kind of cylindrical cutouts before. So it was just interesting. Noticing that.
Let me just connect one further dot there in that respect, Jim. And that is, you have NIST saying, well, they didn't know about ARA's expertise, And then you have ARA demonstrating that when it sees the kind of effects shown at ground zero and in and with respect to the remnants of the World Trade Center complex, that they know exactly how to analyze such effects because that is what they do.
Yes.
And so, therefore, the issue of fraud is made that way because it shows that there's a deliberate attempt not to provide the expertise that they actually have in furtherance of a project where they had a responsibility to do it and to do it right and to do it and be forthcoming about what happened rather than participate in an enterprise that stopped the analytical point before any of the actual effects were to have taken place.
Yes, 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 yes. Yes, I think that's quite a crucial point. And as I'm scanning through this submission, Judy, it's really a rebuttal to their decline to pursue your request for correction. On page 12, I notice is the photographs you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I got to say, this is just a gorgeous piece of work. I mean, I've never really gone through it before, but just scanning it, it's just beautifully organized. And the use of the photographs is so absolutely crucial. I mean, talk about a refutation of Moffat's suggestion that the photographs are unimportant, as he wanted to imply. Nothing could be more the opposite. Indeed, in this case, the photographic evidence is overwhelmingly evident, important. I can't imagine why someone who had their head screwed on right, loosely speaking, would ever offer such a suggestion.
Maybe that was just before he saw my website. Once he saw my website, perhaps he understood and, could see the evidence. But we can talk about some other interesting aspects, too.
Please.
Of what I submitted. There's cases where, like on page 16, figure 20, Tower 1 is disintegrating or whatever it's doing, it's being destroyed, and ahead of the dust cloud that rolled out, you see this white stuff coming out of where all the cars are parked.
Yeah, the fuming of the cars, yes. In advance of the dust cloud hitting them, that's quite striking, isn't it? Because here you got an effect that can't be from the dust cloud because it hasn't reached them yet.
Well, at least not that dust cloud.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe it's a different dust cloud, but it is...
From the south tower.
Or from the north tower. There's various dust clouds. There isn't just one type. And if we start noticing the different types, information comes forward. And you do remember the dirt pictures?
Yes, indeed, indeed.
And all of the dirt that arrives on the scene at Ground Zero, where does it come from?
Stand by. My special guests, Judy Wood and Jerry Liepart. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. We'll be right back. My special guests today are Jerry Liepart and Judy Wood. And Judy, I mean, and just still, my head is spinning. I mean, that this fellow Moffat would decline to come on the show because he thinks photographs aren't important. I mean, good God, this is.
Let's look at the photographs.
Yeah,
it's a lot. They tell a lot. One on from my appeal. I'm looking at page 17.
Yes.
Figure 21 is where I first noticed this. This is the big aha moment. You're upstream, upwind of the Trade Center. Well, both towers have been destroyed. You see the car lot is on fire, so that's a clue. Because that started on fire after Tower 1 was destroyed. So you have a blue sky. Most of the dust has settled out of the air. And then you notice you have this very, very fine dust around the feet of those... firemen or police officers, and you have to ask, how does the fine dust settle out that quickly? It does not. How did it get there?
Yes, 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 yes. I would have thought it was still in the upper atmosphere even.
If you have coarse dust, it lands fairly quickly and settles out of the air. But if it continues breaking down into finer and finer particles, then it might start lifting up. First, I noticed it lifted up with the feet. Then it started lifting up by itself. And in figure 22, you see that fuzziness around their feet.
Yes.
I call it fuzz balls. And let me point out the reason why I use these generic kind of terms. If we want to make observations, we can't use known words for known phenomenon, if we don't know what that mechanism is. For example, is it smoke? Is it dust? Is it chemical, exhaust?
Let me just contribute there, because this, I do this all the time in philosophy. I mean, what you have done by declining to use ordinary language, familiar terms to describe it, is leave open the possibility that the concepts that we would represent by those words may not be what's actually taking place here. So you're actually requiring that we not impose presuppositions on the interpretation of the actual data we're observing.
Right. It's a way of protecting against bias.
Yeah.
Like, you see, you call it smoke because it's whatever color. It may not be smoke. And
yeah.
You're assuming it's fire because you've called it smoke.
Yes.
So just describe it. You could describe scenario 1-2A, but that gets hard to remember. So this is fuzzballs. That's this fuzzy stuff around their feet. That's the name I've given that. And you start noticing that elsewhere in these pictures. And after a while, it starts coming up by itself without the people stepping on it.
Yes.
I call that fuming.
Yes, yes, yes. And, of course, Judy, the other striking feature here, apart from the massive dust that seems to have already settled out, which is extremely surprising, and the fuzzballs, of course, is the paper, the massive amount of paper that one would have presumed had long since gone up in smoke.
If there had been something to cook it.
Yeah. To ignite it.
And then we notice they scrub the streets and they bring in dirt.
Yes.
And if you had something that was floating up into this fumes, putting damp dirt on it might contain it or might absorb it so you can haul it away.
Yes.
If you have some kind of chemical activity going
on. That's right, that would be absorbed by the dirt. I take it at Chernobyl, the principal method of coping with a disaster there was dumping tons of dirt all over the site.
I'm not familiar with that, but I wouldn't doubt it. And then, doing something with the dirt or burying it. And in figure 24 and 25, page 17 of my appeal, we see that pedestrian walkway that goes from WFC3 over to near Building 6. And it's the north walkway, but we see it's full of dirt. This picture was taken, two or three days after 9/11. How did all that dirt get there? Who brought in the dirt? Somebody knows. Somebody knows why they brought in the dirt.
Somebody knew enough to know they needed dirt. And this obviously had to be planned in advance to bring in massive quantities of dirt, which required massive numbers of dump trucks and sources for that dirt. I mean, this is not something you could plan overnight.
And where I first started noticing the dirt, if you go to page 19, figure 29, it looks like fresh new potting soil right out in front of in the front yard of one of the WFC.
It does. It looks like high-quality soil.
Nice damp soil. And then the figure 30, you have this fire truck. A crumpled up fire truck, but you have dirt under it, in it, over it. How did that dirt get there? And figure 31.
It's even in the cab.
Yeah, inside the cab, inside, on the tires, like it was just thrown at it. And in figure 31, we're looking west through where we should see Tower 1. The Tower 1's not there anymore. You see that globe from the fountain. But this is the plaza level. It used to be covered with cement blocks before 9/11. Now there's dirt all over it. Where did the dirt come from?
By the way, when I had Frank Morales, who was, of course, on the scene on 9/11 as a guest on the 2nd, last Tuesday, a week ago Tuesday, he was telling me that actually they referred to the basement level as a pit, that actually the destruction of the towers, Judy, was so great that it was actually below ground level. It's just astounding, below ground level. He was there on the first day, and they were just stunned.
There was nothing there.
Yeah,
the rescue workers walked horizontal or rappelled down into an empty, you know, hole.
Absolutely stunning.
But what is all this dirt? For if anyone's going to investigate it, they could look at into why, who ordered the dirt, why was it brought in, and anyone who is familiar with weapons of mass destruction would be able to identify why you have dirt there, wouldn't they?
One would have thought. It's all obvious. I mean, the presence of the dirt is ubiquitous. It's everywhere.
And it got taller with time. You see in figure 33, 34, 35, it increased.
Yeah, that's really stunning. So they're cleaning up the site, and there's more and more of it to clean up. Stand by. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. I'm Dishing the Dirt with Judy Wood and Jerry Liebhardt. My special guests today are Dr. Judy Wood and attorney Jerry Liebhardt, and we're talking about Judy's previous response to the decline by the NIST to accept her request for correction. And this is a masterful piece of work. You can find it on her website. Go to drjudywood.com, and up in the news section you can get to her lawsuit, and in the lawsuit section you'll see just to the right a link that will take you here to her appeal of the NIST denial. And we're going through some of the photographs here. Judy, I mean, what kind of a case could anyone make? How could you even begin to study 9/11, in particular the destruction of the World Trade Center, without an extensive photographic record?
It's the best hard evidence that we have today.
And that's a point I like to make. I mean, you're here dealing in trading in hard evidence and not just talking about it. So I'm very happy that you're making such excellent use of these resources. We're down to about figure 32 on page 19, I think, and you were talking about the increased accumulation of dirt, perhaps even page 20. Well, look at that.
Yeah, and looking at that last little stub of Building 3, that right in the afternoon of 9/11.
Figure 33?
Yes, and then we see it 5 days later, and then we see it 24 days after the event. 24 days after the event, look at all that dirt. And those diggers, as I call them, pushing dirt around down there.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah. I love it.
Where did the dirt come from? It wasn't there on 9/11.
Yes.
And continuing on to, you know, page 21.
Yes.
And figure 36.
Yes.
That's where the core of Building 1 was, and if you notice, they've been putting dirt down to drive the machinery up and down, and it's this big dirt ramp, but notice it's still fuming through the dirt.
Yes.
They couldn't stop the fuming.
Yes.
And then if you look at figure 37, a close-up from that is figure 38, they're wetting down the dirt the end of October. And you have saturated dirt, fully saturated to the point that the water is leaking out into a puddle, but you have this fuming coming out of the wet dirt.
Fascinating.
Can that be smoke? What is it? It's so peculiar.
And wouldn't you think the more water, the more steam, if there actually were massive pools of molten metal, as some have alleged?
Yeah, you get water sitting still there.
I mean, this seems utterly inconsistent with the thesis of molten metal, if I may say.
Another thing that's quite interesting is that isn't Manhattan a rock? How's the dirt arrived there? If it's a rock and the building's built on bedrock, the bathtub's built on bedrock, and there's stores and paved parking lots and whatever on that turf, on that ground.
Maybe they shipped it in from China in reciprocation for the steel we were sending back to them.
That's a good one.
Look at figure 41 and 40. Looks like maybe Rudy was right there on top of things, Judy. Maybe Rudy was the master of the trucking industry in this day and age.
Read his quote that he said the morning of the 12th.
We were able to move 120 dump trucks out of the city last night, so it should give you a sense of the work that was done overnight. And so some of the debris has already been removed. Most of it has been removed, and it will be done by barge all throughout the day today. 120 dump trucks.
They're not looking for survivors if they're moving out debris like that.
This infuriated firefighters and other first responders, of course, Judy. This is one reason they despise this man, Rudy Giuliani, and they're opposing him as a candidate for President of the United States.
Well, what makes you think that debris actually was removed? With what equipment? How do we know it was just, empty trucks leaving, going out, but bringing in dirt?
Yeah, coming in full and going out empty, because you look at the way in which the piles are accumulating. They're going up. They're not going down. And maybe running the empty trucks is to give you the impression that they were taking out a mass of debris, because, I mean, after all, where's the rest of all those towers? If 80% or more of those towers were turned into very fine dust, then there's not going to be a lot to haul away, is there?
And if the folks in the neighborhood saw these trucks coming and going, they needed to know why.
Yes. Yes.
They'd be given a reason why. Folks who listen to the audio of it, there's a link there if you're interested in listening to the audio of Rudy Giuliani saying that.
Oh, terrific. We're getting quite an earful of Giuliani these days in the presidential campaign, of course.
But the dirt, I would like to know who ordered the dirt, where did it come from, and it also went out as often as it came in. I like changing diapers.
And wouldn't you like to know when the contracts were signed for these 120 dump trucks?
Yeah. And how do you organize 120 dump trucks in 10 minutes in one afternoon with all of that, chaos?
Pretty stunning. Amazing response. I guess it was just like FEMA being Johnny on the spot. I mean, they were there the day before, Judy. They arrived in New York the day before. What an amazing coincidence.
They're just so fast responding that...
Right. That's right. As they would again demonstrate. You know, it's just ironic. Look at Katrina, where they were so slow, and look at New York, where they were so fast. Isn't that an interesting difference?
There's this other phenomenon of the lathering up.
Yeah.
And I show the nice lathering up pictures for
I noticed you got them. They're fantastic all the way, get down to 32 and 33, for example.
Page 32 and 33.
Yes, figures 53 and 54.
That 53 is just amazing. And notice the two-tone coloration is interesting.
Yes, dark at the top.
And then there's some other pictures on page 34 showing Building 7 just really lathering up tremendously. Now, it was said that Building 7 was damaged when Building 1 was destroyed. But if you look at figure 55, you can see the lathering up of both buildings at the same time. Building 1 is still standing, so why is Building 7 lathering up? Same time.
Yes, yes, yes.
And it's so interesting, like in figure 56, how it comes out of just one face, completely, 100% of one face, zero out of the adjacent face.
Yeah, that's what struck me as extremely odd. So in 55, we're actually looking at the North Tower, of course, in the background with the antenna, but right in the foreground, right in front of it, where that separate wire of lighter fuming is coming from the Building 7.
Correct. We're looking at the north side of Building 7, and the lather is what I call this.
God.
It was coming out of the south face of Building 7. And one speculation I have on why just one face, well, if you have a wind from one direction and you're blowing it into the wind, you might get a double dose of it when it blows back onto the building. But this way you can control how much flow you have, because once it blows out of the building, it's gone.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guests, Judy Wood and Jerry Liebhardt. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today, Jerry Liebhardt, attorney from Connecticut, and Judy Wood, researcher of 9/11 extraordinaire. Judy, this is just fascinating stuff. I absolutely love what you and Jerry are doing together. I think this is going to make a huge difference in the history of this case.
And it's the thing the truth movement has been waiting for.
I think it is. That is no overstatement. And as we look at, you know, your use of photographs, which has always seemed to me to be just superlative, I'm hoping that more and more of those who are activists in the 9/11 movement will appreciate the subtlety and perceptivity of your work, which is, in my judgment, unparalleled.
Well, thank you.
Talk about the dust some more, the fuming from the building. Building 7 is so fascinating. We were on page 34.
The lathering up.
The lathering up. And could you comment a bit more on the meaning of lathering up? Because obviously that's a form of preparation, not unlike lathering up a man's face for being shaved by a barber.
Or like lathering up in the shower, too.
Yes.
It's so striking that, and it's, you see that in each of the buildings, including Tower 2, which went first, but because it was the first one to be destroyed, it couldn't be as obvious. And they used a darker type of lather. And, you know, I've drawn the analogy with photographic emulsion. If you're going to try to burn a photograph into a piece of paper, that's going to be pretty hard, and it's going to take a lot of intense energy. But if you try to capture an image on photographic emulsion, it just takes a teeny bit of light to do that, and you have different speeds of film. I believe that the lathering up of different colors is like a different speed of film. It has different sensitivities. Some is easier to control than others, but the reaction takes place within it. But whatever it is, it's something we have not seen before. Steel turns to dust. You can look at pictures like figure 94 on page 47, where you see...
Page 47.
Yeah, and the appeal. You see the steel flying through the air, trailing dust, and you don't hear reports of the steel hitting the ground.
Yes.
It's turned to dust by then.
Yes. In fact, you can see the fuming, you know, trailing off behind it with the wheat checks there on the picture of 94, figure 94.
Yes, and if you notice in figure 93, you have little pieces of aluminum cladding.
Yes.
Not trail dust.
Yes.
So it actually...
It affects steel differentially. It affects steel differently than aluminum.
It's very material specific.
Very material specific.
And this interest in dirt... I think there's a lot to be had there. That's how you clean up chemical spills. That's how you clean up toxic sites.
Dirt again.
With the dirt.
You're down to 97, 98, and 99, for example.
97 and 98, that's...
Yeah, 99 is the dust from the tower's destruction, yeah.
Right. But 97 and 98 is quite interesting. 97, if you look at that car on the right-hand side, it's missing an engine.
Uh-huh.
It still has the hood, sort of. It, you know, where'd the engine go? Why, what would cause that to disintegrate? So it's a very intriguing puzzle, but it's so obvious and in your face. After reviewing the photographs, you can't ignore it. It becomes very apparent.
Completely fascinating.
When I was looking on ARA's website, I saw these two particular pictures. Those are the last two, figure 100A and 100B.
100A and 100B.
100A is fascinating. It's a drawing, but it reminds me of a view looking south on West Street. And you can see what looks like Tower 3, WTC 3 in the distance, the Marriott Hotel, that angled building.
Yeah.
And it looks like you have Tower 2 in the far distance. In the foreground, you have a building with part of it just gone, disintegrated. Now, where'd it go? Is that supposed to be Building 6? What are they trying to tell us? That they can poof buildings that look just like the World Trade Center?
Real strange. Where did this come from exactly? I mean, ARA, but I mean, in what kind? Oh, that's a tank there, Judy. Look at that, right in front of the building, you got a tank.
Yep. This is a drawing from their website where they're trying to show their capabilities.
Their capabilities. Yes, well, that's one of their capabilities, and it sure looks similar to the, you know, their capabilities can bring about effects that look very similar to the effects that we observe at the World Trade Center.
And why does that, you know, the Marriott Hotel was a very unique building with that angle in it.
Uh-huh.
There's not a lot of buildings that look like that.
Yes, and there it is. So why is it cast in that drawing?
Pretty interesting. And that second figure on the right, 100B, the World Trade Center complex is glowing red.
Almost radioactive. Very strange, very strange, very strange. And in 100A, Judy, I mean, you got this thing in the background that looks sort of like a tornado.
Yeah, it's just shooting up. And there's, I start out with those same two figures where I show what I believe that they look very similar to. If we look up at figure one.
Mm-hmm. Go all the way to figure one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll go right back up there.
On page three?
Yes, 1A, 1B. Oh, yeah, you got them right there.
And then look at the bottom of that page.
Look at
figure five. Doesn't
that
look like that tornado thing?
Yeah, rather much. Not to mention figure two looking like 1A.
Yeah, and that's Oklahoma City's on the left, that mirror building. And then WTC 6 is on the one on the right of that first picture.
Fascinating. God, fascinating.
So there's a lot to be seen. And so these aren't just, you know, standalone sites that you say, well, never seen anything like it before.
It's like our professor of physics at the conference who said, that, you know, Margaret, after listening to your presentation, she observed, I don't know how I didn't see these things before.
We were trained not to see them. The psychological aspects of this deterred people from noticing these things. We were told to see something else.
And when you're told what you're seeing, the mind tends to impose closure. You tend to connect various dots, even if they don't belong together or if they don't even exist.
And folks don't want to go back and review and rethink things because they're going to be living the horror all over again. So you just want to take it and go. Like the first responders, they describe in their transcripts, they describe horrible scenes. And they say, well, you just had to not think.
Yes.
And I think that's what it was designed for. Because if they would think, well, both the towers are still standing. There were fumes coming out of the ground area.
Yes.
At the base of them. Why didn't the firefighters recognize something is strange here?
Would you say that we could appropriately characterize what happened to the World Trade Center in a phrase that we heard before from Secretary Rumsfeld, namely, shock and awe?
Yes. It had to be shock and awe above anything we've ever seen before on TV or movies.
Inducing a kind of psychological trauma that makes us vulnerable to impressions?
Correct. If you've seen on various live footage, a police officer is yelling at somebody, get down on the ground, get down on the ground, and the person immediately does. It's a panic response, sort of an instinct. So there's this terror response that humans have. And I believe that's what was tapped into.
Judy and Jerry, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. I think this is enormously important. We're going to be sending this out to all the members of Scholars. We're going to be posting it on our website. You're doing wonderful work. I can't thank you enough. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Thank everyone for listening.